From Public Radio International, I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. What young college graduates should know and be able to do is suddenly a hot question again. The Bush administration frets aloud that the American prosperity machine won't have scientists and engineers for the global century, not half as many as India and China. It's a different complaint at the private pinnacles of higher learning in the U.S., where the best and brightest worry that the naked pressure for profitability in global markets could squeeze the imagination, the human sympathy, the questioning of authority, the joy out of U.S. college degrees that may be our most important, most coveted product. No serious school is exempt from some new rules today. That innovation is constant, that connecting cultural traditions are multiple and multiplying, that universities aren't training scholars so much as citizens and players for a precariously integrated global environment. When your parents' education won't do, what will is next on Open Source. First, the news. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, a radio conversation among lifelong learners who speak their minds at radioopensource.org. The puzzle for colleges, universities, and us this hour is how and what to teach the next generation of graduates who will be called on, as Avek Fritz writes on our page, to reverse global warming and nuclear proliferation, to live and let live with Islam, to support their aged parents and pay off record debts, all the while walking justly and cultivating the inward and invisible profundities of music, dance, and religious mystery. Take your own shot at rewriting your college curriculum or your nieces and nephews at our website, www.radioopensource.org. We begin with the philosopher Martha Nussbaum at the University of Chicago. She's as close as we have in this country to a queen of the humanities, professor of law and ethics at the University of Chicago Law School. Martha Nussbaum, welcome to Open Source. Curriculum reform is absolutely nothing new, but it's all the rage from Washington West. Decode this kind of moment and all the things that people are telling us about the new global, technologically transformed and postmodern world of college students.
Country that I've been in India and I've been in various other European countries about how to educate people for a world that is increasingly globalized. But I'm afraid that this debate, a lot of it focuses too narrowly. I loved your introduction because you mentioned so many things that we have to do in this world, but a lot of this debate focuses only on the global market and how we can get our countries to be profitable actors in the global market. And I think that is very bad because it's going to neglect the other things, the problems solving abilities that you mentioned.
But it is important, and it's what American college educations have done for this country for the 20th century anyway, right?
To cultivate that, I really think that you need to cultivate the imagination, the innovative capacities, and the critical capacities that the humanities so very much cultivate. I mean, we all know that in a business where no one is going to raise a voice of criticism, that's going to create a corrupt business environment. But I'm afraid that even some very good writers about education are thinking, well, we better go over to rote learning more, because look at what's made some developing countries to make such great progress. They stuff people full of information, and I think we're losing sight of the things that even in business and industry have made us a great country.
Well, go back to the root strengths that people come here for. I mean, it is engineering and medicine and science and all that sort of thing, but it is the multifarious joys of an American campus, certainly since World War II. This is where everybody in the world wants to come. Why?
Attractive about our model is that it does have this idea of liberal education. That is what originally meant education for freedom, for a self-governing life that's an integrated life, that involves thinking critically, that involves imagining, that also involves learning a great deal about the world and then majoring in one subject. Whatever the reason is, we're the only country in the world that really has that for the first 2 years of education. And so other countries where they specialize so soon often find that very attractive. I think particularly for women, it's really, really attractive as a way of empowering them and getting them to take charge of their lives. And I've seen liberal arts proposals for women in Bangladesh and other parts of the world where they really would like to make that happen.
You've written, I think it's you, I've read so many education reports lately, but I think it was you writing about a kind of Socratic self-criticism at the core of a great education, and
yeah,
in a new way, a kind of visions of a heterogeneous world that we all live in. How do you put a price tag on it, but then how do you make sure it's at the core of a university experience?
I thought about this a lot when I wrote about higher education, because I think Socrates was right, that democracies will die if they're not constantly stung by this, he called himself a gadfly on the back of a noble but sluggish horse. So we need the sting of that kind of critical thinking if we're going to keep democracy deliberative and keep it alive. I actually think requiring courses in philosophy is the best way to institutionalize that. I mean, of course, critical thinking should be through the whole curriculum, but I think that the reality is that courses in philosophy, by which I mean not just formal logic, but courses focused on ethical dilemmas, which are taught in a very serious way with small classes, with lots of feedback on student writing and lots of student discussion, are the best way of institutionalizing that.
Martha Nussbaum, I'd like you to, you've spoken in effect about the Bush administration Spellings Commission, which deals very specifically with this matter of economic competitiveness in a globalized world. There's also a Harvard, faculty study now out on changing the curriculum. I wish you would help decode the big things they're talking about, including these new to me five areas of inquiry and experience, including the diversity of cultural traditions, the ethical life, the United States in relationship to the world, reason and faith, which is kind of intriguing, religion as an inescapable fact of 21st century life, and then also science and technology. What does that, all of that push tell us?
Well, I haven't read the Harvard thing. In fact, I'll be visiting at Harvard in the spring, so I look forward to talking about that. But it sounds like they've made a lot of progress in thinking about how they want to reconstruct the curriculum, because for a while it looked like the whole emphasis on the moral life was going to drop out, and even the emphasis on confronting other cultures was not going to be central. There's also the report of the Association of American Colleges and Universities, which is a very creative and dynamic one, which really lays out the abilities that students should develop. And I guess I like that focus, because I think that you can cultivate, let's say, the sympathetic imagination through a lot of different kinds of courses. And so if you keep your eye on what abilities you're developing, that'll help you think what areas you should have. In this world, we really need to learn to understand each other much better than we do, and to talk across cultural boundaries. And that means quite a lot of things: learning about the major world religions, learning a lot about the global economy, learning about cultural diversity in a way that most Americans have not. Certainly in my day, we learn very little outside North America and Europe. So all of those things are very important, but I do think that learning how to think ethically, by which I mean not just basking in the thought that you could be a good person, but I mean really learning how to think rigorously and critically about ethical dilemmas in the way I think a good undergraduate philosophy course will provide. All of these are really very, very central abilities.
Martha Nussbaum, I want to come back to you on a better phone line to this question of what it means to be teaching, significantly teaching religion in every liberal college, on every sort of enlightened college campus. That's something kind of new in this context. But I also want to introduce Susan Gallagher, professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts Lowell. Susan, you're teaching at a great industrial center with a new population, including a significant Cambodian population, for this same changed world. What's your experience of these fundamental curriculum questions at UMass Lowell?
Well, I would say it depends on the context. I mean, we can talk about teaching students all these great things, but I think there's a set of values that we have to really think about. Again, I don't have the solution, but there's a set of values that needs to be inculcated first. We can talk about, like, becoming citizens and, a functioning democracy. But what I see in my students is a declining appreciation, for example, of the importance of accuracy, of the importance of honesty. Mm-hmm. And so Martha Nussbaum is talking about ethical dilemmas. I don't blame students for this. They see, wrongdoing constantly at the highest levels of every, aspect of American society now. And this idea that it's better to be honest than dishonest, they seem to struggle with this a lot more, and especially more over the last few years.
How are your kids on the scale of the capacity I spoke about at the beginning to reverse global warming and nuclear proliferation to live with a completely close other world, to pay off all sorts of debts. I mean, what are the obstacles in the way of your kids being the master citizens of the 21st century?
Well, I would say time. I mean, one of the aspects of, you know, people all recognize there seems to be some sort of crisis in education, but the larger context, which is this general social speed up, which preceded the, you know, information explosion, where now, I mean, we have just yesterday the report in Massachusetts that worker productivity has risen 50% since 1989, and wages have gone up 1%. Now, if your productivity has risen 50% and you're not making any more money, then, you know, you have a sense, you know, your whole life, the quality of your life is lowered. And so that these are our students' parents. And so they see their overworked parents. They don't have time. You know, that's one of the main things. Our students don't have time to wrestle with ethical dilemmas. You know, they're working jobs. They're going to school full time. You know, they... So this idea of, you know, this wide, you know, enlivening humanities education, not only do they have to get to the next quiz, get to the next test, you know, but it's a grind. You know, we're losing, like I always say to the students, that they're so busy with school that they don't have time for education.
Where does that Socratic self-criticism and cultural, you know, kick back the gadfly response, are you teaching that? Are you able to teach that to your kids?
Well, I think less and less. I mean, as we get more of an assembly line approach to education in this country, I mean, the standardized test curriculum, the teaching to the test, the never a minute to spare, the reviewing on Saturdays, the ton of homework, you know, that whole thing of education as unfreedom. And that's the way my students seem to approach it. Mm. It's another chore. So they say, like, well, why do we have to read Toni Morrison's Beloved? You know, what are we going to get out of it? What's at the end? Are you going to quiz us on it? And so the idea of education for its own sake, and I understand that this
Martha
is
Nussbaum
part of
would say it's about the cultivation of sympathy. I want to know how that works at UMass Lowell, too. We're talking about curriculum reform on Open Source. We'll be right back.
This is Dave Miller, Open Source Senior Producer. Following last night's show about Anna Politkovskaya's murder, our new intern Jessica emailed some Finnish mourners to learn more about why Politkovskaya was so revered in Northern Europe. You can read about it on the site. Also, we saw an enormous bird of prey outside our back door today. Maybe a hawk, maybe a falcon. We do know that it was eating a rat strip by strip all afternoon. We've put some G-rated pictures on our site and are hoping you can tell us who our new neighbor is. So please, help us identify him at radioopensource.org.
Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio Boston. This is Open Source from PRI. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're reforming the curriculum this hour with Martha Nussbaum, who's back in Chicago, and Susan Gallagher in the studio from the University of Massachusetts Lowell. What stands in the way of the ideal curriculum, Susan Gallagher, for students at UMass Lowell?
I would say time, pressure, and also that because we now emphasize the value of competition so heavily, and competition militates against education. I mean, there's the values are, I think, fundamentally opposed. Education, we learn how to do things for their own sake, and competition, and Martha Nussbaum can speak much more eloquently than I can on this, and competition, is to get ahead. It's a non-educational value.
What does the public culture of our time do for or against 19-year-old kids struggling to become educated citizens?
Well, I was struck. I saw a clip of George Bush's education summit yesterday with Margaret Spellings and other people around this table, and they were sitting in this fake classroom, and it had a big, fake blackboard behind them, and they were talking about, how to prevent violence in schools, and they wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole any larger issues, it seems to me once you install the metal detectors at the door of the schoolhouse, you've already lost a great deal. The battle is almost lost. I mean, if you have to search the students to make sure that they're not armed before they get there, and if safety is going to be your main preoccupation, like are our children safe at school, then, we're so far, then what are we going to talk about, curriculum reform in this atmosphere of militarized education and worry that your students, not that they're not learning, but that they might be dead?
I was thinking of the clip of President Bush at Yale, where he got an honorary degree in 2001, and he said, "I'm here to show you that a C student can become president of Yale, but the real lesson is don't flunk out the way Dick Cheney did from the Yale. Also, you'll only get to be vice president." And I thought the cue there, on one side of their mouth, they're talking about competing with China, getting smart. At another level, they're talking about really almost advocating a culture of stupidity.
Yeah, I mean, there's
don't worry about your education, kids.
Yeah. I mean, there's also, you can be highly educated and anti-intellectual at the same time. And I see that a lot in our university system, where there's not, neither the students nor the faculty, have either the time or the inclination, it seems, to speculate, to theorize, to imagine, as Martha Nussbaum has pointed out, that the importance of that. If you're being bombarded with information, and the information is, like for the nightly news, it's just fodder and grist. I mean, or it's just, if the news is Mark Foley's, IM messages, this smutty gibberish, then, and that's the level of our discourse, then there's no place anymore for any, great books, which are not necessarily all written by dead white men. I mean, but for things of beauty, of things that are awesomely inspiring. I mean, my students, they are reduced to being grinds, not by their own fault, but by this incredibly competitive, pressurized system in which they live.
Martha Nussbaum, do we dare talk about anti-intellectualism in America?
Oh, I think we have to, yeah. I mean, I think, in most countries of the world, there's at least a respect for the academic as somebody who could contribute to the public debate. And in this nation, I mean, it's much harder for academics to participate in public debate through newspapers, through journals and so on than in any other country I've ever been in. I mean, I could get my ideas out there much more easily in India and Holland and almost any other place, and the general public has a hunger for these ideas. But somehow or other, we've constructed things in such a way that they don't get out there.
It seems to me you could make just as good an argument that the internet and blogs, if I may say, are as good an instrument for intellectuals of every stripe, certified or not, to talk to a hungry culture, as never before.
Well, there's great good in that, and it does make something like the International Women's Movement possible. But Cass Sunstein, my colleague, has also, in his book Republic.com, he shows that when people go on the internet, they often just seek out what they already are identified with, what they already like, and they get more balkanized than before. They don't encounter ideas that they didn't know before. And so I think, it depends how you use it, but a lot of people use the internet to just reinforce their pre-existing convictions.
So many points to touch on here, but a phrase I see in these conversations is the argument that only 10% of college graduates today are, in a phrase, globally prepared. What does that mean, and how do we get around it, or how do we change it?
it really means, first and foremost, an openness of mind, a real curiosity, and a willingness to admit that you don't know everything, a knowledge, as Socrates would say, of your own ignorance. Because we all think we know what a family is. We think we know what a business is and so on, but we've never often studied the different ways that families are organized around the world. And I think what a liberal education does at its best is to make you aware of your own ignorance, so that even if you don't learn everything about every country in the world, you know what you don't know and you know how to inquire.
But seriously, how do you build curiosity, humility, openness into a college curriculum? Assume you must, but then how do you do it?
You know, I think kids are by nature curious, and I think it doesn't take much to stimulate that if it hasn't been killed off in high school. Now, I think what was being said about the pressure is true, and that a lot of high school students are just burned out by the time they get to college. But let's suppose they get there relatively intact. Then I think there's so many ways that good teaching can enliven the mind. And I think having small classes, having regular assessment of the student's own writing and oral participation is absolutely key. Because in the minute you just put them into a huge lecture hall with the multiple choice testing, as happens in a lot of places around the world, then I think you lose them entirely, and they're just not curious anymore.
Are your students curious, Susan Gallagher?
Some of them are. I don't want to make any blanket statements. And I also don't want to be, one, I don't want to start singing the what's the matter with kids today at all. And also I don't want because I don't think it's their problem. They're not any dumber than previous generations. They have a lot less time, and they're under a lot more pressure. And also, I think their professors had a much easier time of it. But the other thing is, the problem that I encounter constantly in my courses is cynicism, is that the students, they don't, like, they, I had my students the other day analyze television commercials. They went to a website that had all of these political ads on it. It was TV ads. And they analyzed them all as performance without regard to the veracity of any of the ads. And so they thought of successful ads. Ads were successful even if they knew that they were untrue. And that was, it was an interesting, one interesting example in that they don't expect to encounter the truth. They don't expect to, for public speakers to be, you know, offering them anything but a bill of goods. And so I think, and that deadens curiosity more than anything else, because there's nothing to get to. There's no real truth. There's only a series of sensations that then just pass away. And I think that, you know, it occurred to me again, looking at that, you know, sort of fake educational summit that Bush was at the other day, that 1984 was a long time ago. And that we're beyond, you know.
You're talking about a cynicism that's beyond politics in a way. It's almost a philosophical cynicism.
Yes, because, I mean, I'm really curious to, I don't understand why my students don't value accuracy. And they just don't have it as a value. And I think part of that is that...
Even after you mark their papers?
No, actually what I do basically... It, when I can, is I rewrite their papers. And when they see the thoughts they were trying to express rewritten in a more exact form, then they get it. But I can't rewrite all of their papers. And I, by this process of rewriting and saying, you know what, this verb is more accurate than the one that you chose, then they can see it in action and they can relate to it. And out of that process, I usually get, you know, a few transformations of students. But they arrive in the classroom without an appreciation of the importance of exactitude, of accuracy, of getting it right. It doesn't seem to be in their pantheon.
Haven't they studied Wikipedia? I mean, a lot of them research their papers in Wikipedia, where the competition, forgive that word, but the alertness 24/7 to make sure Wikipedia is as close
yes,
as
but
can
notice
be,
that's
is
a perfect
intense.
Example. It's a perfect example. It's what seems to be true right now. And it changes. So Wikipedia entries change as different people get a hold of them. And so then the truth becomes this malleable thing. And there doesn't seem to be any memory for, you know, what seemed to be true yesterday is not true today. And I think that this is part of the way information is delivered now, that information is a flash in the pan, that it is, it doesn't last, it has no shelf life. And so the students have no, you know, not only that they're not in a position to sort of to get cultural references, they're not in a position to get historical references. They've never had time to study these things. It's never been on the agenda. And this is, I have to say, early on, we're only beginning to see the results of the test-taking grind. And it's going to get worse. I mean, the test-takers and the grinds are now, a lot of them, they've gone through college and graduate school, they're arriving on faculties. They're fundamentally uneducated people. They haven't had a liberal education. They don't know literature. They don't know anything outside of their very small.
Before we're done, we're going to figure out how they can get it, how they will get it. But Martha Nussbaum, I'm just listening to these recitations of kind of the symptoms of postmodern fragmentation, of digitized, everywhere and nowhere information. It seems to me this is the big change. Although in my own experience as a lifelong learner, if I may say, it's a great liberation. How do you deal with it? How do you feel about?
Well, I guess I don't see that deep a cynicism in my students, and maybe it's because people go to philosophy only if they are interested in precision. I don't know, but I also want to say that in India, where I've gone around with a lot of non-governmental organizations that are working on women's education and working children's education, I see that even though they have no time at all, and they're usually working 8-hour days at some very demanding manual job, they have such a passion for learning and for the truth about their own situation. So I think maybe part of our problem is we're too comfortable. When people really are living on the margins of society and they have to survive, then it matters passionately to them what the truth of their situation is. And they go to learn to read precisely because they have to figure out their situation. So
I'm glad you mentioned India, partly because Amartya Sen was telling us, in effect, that the great Indian dynamo, the economic dynamo that we sometimes worry about, was also trained in Silicon Valley. They have learned, their best people have learned, got their best education in the United States. What sort of counterexample are American universities getting abroad now, especially in India and China, in the new industrial challenges?
Well, you know, India is a very odd case because it has some of the richest traditions of progressive education. Rabindranath Tagore in the early 20th century was doing the sorts of things that Dewey did, but I think doing them more richly, involving the arts and critical thinking and so on. But then that fell out of fashion, and there was so much teaching to the test and so much force feeding and rote learning, and that is still the dominant approach in the government schools. Now, that's one reason why rich Indians want to send their kids to the U.S. so that they get a much more critical and diverse kind of education. But, you know, right now there's a lot of dissatisfaction with that, too. And so there's an attempt to rethink pedagogy and to build something richer. And see, what I see is the education of the poorest people that are not in school, who are working. And there, at that end of the most impoverished end of the spectrum, you have terrific progressive education going on because people know that the women won't come after 8 hours working in the fields if something exciting is not happening there. And they make that happen. So I guess I think that it's at the high end and the low end of society that the exciting things are happening in India, and then in the middle is where you have the dismal rote learning and people can't get out of that.
Susan Gallagher, you're somewhere in the middle. I'm wondering, how do you teach your own cynical students your reverence for truth? What can a committed and earnest teacher do?
Well, I mean, I think this thing about, you know, redefining the curriculum and you know, taking a new approach to education. Well, I mean, we all agree now that there's no way that to define some kind of body of knowledge that we want all college students to have. The body is just way too big to jam into anyone's head. So people talk about modes of inquiry. But with my students, I actually try to teach them a level of attention, a degree of concentration, because it's a relief from the world. It's been described on the they all go, you know, the internet is their main medium of education now. And they are, they suffer from what people who study information literacy call this butterfly effect. They alight for a moment and then they go on to the next thing. They alight for a moment, they go on to the next thing. And there's not any time to stop, to consider, to reflect, or to ponder.
How do you teach your kids anti-cynicism? How do you immunize them? Is there a way?
I actually give them exercises. I have very specific, you know, I use newspaper articles and I say, okay, I'm going to give you a formula, a secret, you know, code that will allow you to unlock the untruth inside of this newspaper article. And it's if you, and I just say, you just got to pay attention to the meaning of words. And, you know, this one example I always use in my classes is, it was just a minor article in the Manchester Union Leader about, and it had to do with the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church. And the headline was, auditors laud diocese. And so they had these auditors come in and say that the diocese was doing a great job. And so I have the students just think about that headline. What are auditors? Do auditors laud? No, auditors measure. They count. So the fishiness of the story was apparent in the headline, that auditors really don't celebrate and congratulate. They don't say what a great job. They're supposed to just count in an objective fashion. And so I try to get the students to see, if you look closely at the meaning of words, you know, if you notice that what people say when they fall into the passive voice, that you're being bamboozled. And so they like this idea of
mistakes were made.
Exactly. And so when I say, look, if you pay close attention not only to what other people are saying in writing, but to what you yourself are writing, you'll think more clearly. You'll be able to, you know, your mind will not be such a disorganized mess. And that they find that appealing. And I mean, it doesn't take with all of them. But that idea of being able to see through lies does awaken their willingness to look further.
Martha Nussbaum, how do you teach your kids to be Socratic?
Well, you know, I love what Susan said, and I would love to be in her class. I think the dialogues of Plato are a pretty good place to start, because the life of Socrates, first of all, is very gripping. And just to see a man in a democracy that's full of people who think they know what they're talking about, who irritates them so much that they want to put him to death, and then he's willing to take that death rather than to give up what he's doing. Well, that moves people, and it gets them to see that somebody could actually give his life for truth and good arguments. But then just to study those arguments, and you can kind of see that these people are very much like modern politicians. They sound off, they say things, and they think that they're very great. And then very quickly, Socrates gets them to see that they actually are contradicting themselves, and they don't know what they're talking about. And so the drama that unfolds in one of those dialogues is very exciting for people, and then they can put that to work themselves.
We're going to reform the curriculum by reading Orwell's Politics of the English Language, which is all about usage, and Plato's History of Socrates. We're talking about curriculum reform on Open Source. We'll be right back. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We're talking about what you must learn in college today. Amardeep Singh is a professor of English at Lehigh University. He blogs at Amardeep Singh. We spoke with him earlier today and asked him how he uses technology to teach humanities.
I think understanding ideas that relate to literature, understanding how students themselves can take what they're seeing in a novel or a work of creative nonfiction, for instance, and apply it to their lives and see their own lives, kind of see themselves related to it in some way, even if they're reading a book about, you know, a poor villager in India written 50 years ago, that there's something about that that really technology doesn't help them get. What helps them get is first of all, their own personal experience of picking up the book and actually sitting down and reading it. And the second part of it is that kind of environment of challenge that you get in a live classroom where they challenge each other, I challenge them, and yes, they challenge me as the professor in terms of understanding it, interpreting it, figuring out a way to make it relevant, to make it kind of something that they can use in their own lives. You can at best use those technological tools as tools, but they don't substitute for what you're primarily trying to do and what really seems to work best in that live environment.
That was Amardeep Singh, English professor at Lehigh. You can find him at his blog, Amardeep Singh, S-I-N-G-H. For the other side of that argument, here's David Schaefer, who joins us from Madison, Wisconsin. He's a game scientist, professor of learning science at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. His forthcoming book is called How Computer Games Can Help Children Learn. David Schaefer, welcome. Make the case that technology, in a certain way, can fight us out of this impasse.
Well, I think it's important that to recognize that the impasse that we're in is partly, not entirely, obviously, but in a large extent, created by technology. So the globalization that you're talking about, and many of the issues that go along with it, you mentioned global warming, nuclear war, debt. Even our sense of justice are all impacted by and to some extent created by the technologies that we have. And I guess at the core, it's important to recognize that the technologies that are creating this increasingly complicated, increasingly fast-paced world are technologies that don't just transform the things that we do in the world. They actually transform the way that we think. A way to think about that is that the computers are a technology that changes things on the order of things that come once in a millennium, like the development of writing, the printing press. A way to understand that is that one of the things that what writing does is essentially let us, it takes care of remembering for us. So a shopping list does that. A book even does that. If you want to use the language of business, it outsources it so that we don't have to do it. What computers do is they actually make it possible to let the technology to outsource pieces of thinking itself. So you do that when you use a calculator to do mathematical calculations or a spreadsheet to do your family budget, or even when someone flies a plane now, for the most part what they're doing is telling the computer what they want the plane to do and the computer is figuring out how to do it.
But you've I think you just heard Amardeep Singh saying that the critical moments in education are reading alone, what my father used to call applying the seat of your pants to the seat of your chair and keeping it there, and then the classroom challenge.
Well,
arguing it, debating it, defending it, not the technology.
Well, those are two of the critical things, but they certainly aren't all of the critical things. It's certainly important to be able to have the patience to read a book and to enjoy reading it and to love doing it, and it's certainly important to be able to discuss books with other people. But if you want to solve global warming, that's clearly not sufficient, and the same would be true for nuclear power or getting along in an increasingly multicultural world.
The question is whether you know how to train the people who will deal with global warming. I'm just wondering, Susan Gallagher, is technology, as David's speaking about it, your friend or not?
Well, it could be. I take a much more pessimistic view of the, even as much as I'm in favor of using technology as much as we possibly can and having every classroom be wired and making the world's, you know, great literature available to everyone, you know, via the internet. I think we also have to deal with the ways in which, in fact, talking about knowledge, like even saying that it's great for people to have the patience required to read a book. Like we've already come some distance when we're having that sentence that it requires patience rather than you know, an appetite for knowledge, an appreciation of beauty, a need to be moved, and, you know, instead of patience. And I think that this is also a problem we have to deal with because, again, I see with my students that they get the world in these very quick slices. And so now that it's possible to view a page of a text on Google, and you can buy chapters of books rather than books, and pretty soon you can buy sentences, I'm sure. You'll be able to buy sentences. Then we won't need, you know, the patience to read a book. We won't need to read the book. We can just buy the sentence.
Martha Nussbaum, I'm wondering, how does a classical humanist, a Socrates person, feel about teaching technologies of the David Schaefer stripe?
Well, you know, I think they're tools, and they're very powerful tools. And so, but we have to remember that we are the ones who are setting the goals, and it's our own mental activity and our own mental freedom that will decide whether we use them well or badly. And so I'm with Amardeep Singh in thinking that some of the most valuable moments we want to produce are moments inside the mind and for which these technologies can be wonderful tools. I mean, for example, students with disabilities could not have been integrated into university classrooms in the way that they now are. I mean, students who are blind, who are paralyzed, and so on. So these technologies have great potential for making those moments of mental freedom possible for more people than were possible before. But, of course, they can be distracting, they can be abused, and I think I slightly disagree with Susan Gallagher. I guess I think students always needed to learn patience. It wasn't like my generation had a natural affinity for beauty, but so for all students at all times, we have to keep this distinction between the ends and the means.
David Schaefer, give us an example of a video game and how it works as a teaching tool.
Well, if I might, though, I'd actually like to respond to something that Martha just said, because I agree with a lot of what everybody said all along. But you know, the irony is that, and I'm not a philosopher, but that Socrates, in fact, argued that books were a bad thing, and that in fact all knowledge should come from dialogue, from talking with other people. But I think everybody on the panel agrees that that in fact one of the things that you need to be able to do is to use books, to use this particular technology, and to be able to think with it, to understand how it works well enough, to have enough experiences with it, to be able to use it to free the mind. And all I'm saying is that the same thing is true about newer technologies. That is, it is of course important that we need to master books and the skills that go with them, and conversation and the skills that go with those, and debate and so forth.
Give us the experience, David,
that we have to master as well if we want to be able to solve the kinds of problems that we want young people to be prepared to solve.
Give us the experience of one of your video game devices.
Well, sure, there are a lot of them. I mean, it's interesting that Susan was raising the question of accuracy, and of course, the interesting thing about accuracy is that what's important is being able to marshal the correct kinds of evidence, the appropriate kinds of evidence to make the argument that you want to make, and to see whether or not somebody else has done that. It's actually an old word, another old Greek word, the idea of epistemology. That is, how is it that you know something is true? And of course, one of the things that is clear in the technological age is that there are lots of different ways of deciding what information you need, whether it's accurate and whether it's appropriate. Each different profession, each different practice in the world has different tools that it uses. So a lawyer and a doctor and an engineer all decide things differently. So one of the things that you can do with video games is you can give players, you can give young students of any age the experience of thinking the way a doctor thinks about a problem or thinking the way a lawyer thinks about a problem. And you can actually assess and reflect and do all the things that those practices in the world do. You can do the same, of course, for being a journalist and an historian and a philosopher as well. What a good game can do is create a virtual world where you act and think like somebody who actually solves problems in the world, to learn that way of thinking, to learn that epistemology.
Second life, Susan Gallagher, do you believe it?
Well, again, I think that this vocational approach to education is like that you think like a lawyer, you think like a doctor, you occupy your own small space, whereas the idea of commonality, so that everybody is reading Toni Morrison or everyone is reading Great Expectations, So, and not for any purpose except for doing it. I mean, not for any purpose except to have the experience of reading a great piece of literature, not to necessarily to solve problems. But actually, I would say you actually get the passion from these great works of art, from these great works of literature. So you have a reason why you want to solve global warming.
Speaking of technology in the classroom, Razib is a longtime favorite open source commenter. He blogs at Gen Expression. We spoke with him earlier today and asked about his own recent experience getting a second BA.
The way people are being taught today, I mean, you have a background of like technology that you take for granted. So a lot of times within classes, note-taking is totally different than it was 5 or 6 years ago because you know that the notes are going to be online that evening. So when people aren't paying attention, sometimes it's because they know that the notes are going to be online. Or sometimes the professor will be like, okay, I'm going to be talking about something extremely complicated right now. Stop taking notes. Stop writing and just focus on me because it's going to be online and you're going to have to review it. That couldn't have happened 5 years ago because notes are just a necessary part of a classroom discussion or like discourse back then. Now they're a supplement and they're there to aid you learning, but the notes are always going to be there anyways online when you get home. Sometimes it's bad because students just check out or they don't show up for class if they know that it's not going to be necessary. But sometimes it's good because the professor will go into something in more detail than they otherwise would because they're not restricted to just assuming that people are going to have to write it down and write the whole chart or schematic down. So they bring a lot more visual aids sometimes, I think, than they would because they're not expecting you to sketch it because you're going to be able to see it online later that evening.
David Chaffery, it sounds as if colleges are making the classroom a more intense experience, maybe even with performance, not to mention, you know, PowerPoint slides, with the new technology. Is this a good thing?
Well, I think Razib Khan is making a great point because, of course, before the printing press in the 1400s, say, the way that lectures worked is that the students wrote down literally as much as they could of what the professor was saying because that was their only textbook. They didn't have a resource that they could turn to. And, of course, teaching has changed in the last 500 years. And what he's pointing to is the idea that, in fact, new technologies change the way that we present information. I think it's a good and a necessary thing. I think even more important than that is not just thinking about how we teach, but about thinking about what's worth teaching at all. It's not just whether or not technology can make the same subjects or the same content either more accessible or accessible in more places or something that you can learn more quickly, but actually ask the question what things are worth spending time thinking about in the first place.
Susan Gallagher.
Well, I would say, I do think, I mean, going back to the earlier point in the discussion, I do see a lot of students now who have never read a book. And they've read textbooks in schools, but they've never read a novel. They've just never had an opportunity to read a book, and the curriculum is going beyond that. Instead, they're taking tests. They're learning how to think like lawyers, but they're not reading literature. And again, it's not for me like this elitist traditional education. I don't think is the solution. But I see a level of impoverishment among my students. They've never been exposed to great literature.
Robin Amer, who reads a book a day, is minding the blog store.
I try. I can't always live up to that ideal, Chris. We have a question on our blog from the person who goes by the name Web Gremlin. He says that effective communication should be a primary goal of college education, but something that often prohibits this aspect of college life is the tendency to seclude students away from the cities and surrounding communities where the universities are located. So the question for Susan Gallagher is, do you think universities and students are integrated enough into their surrounding communities?
No. I think that, I mean, for one thing, academic discourse, I mean, there's a lot of problems with this. One of the questions we haven't addressed is that the production of knowledge in colleges and universities now has really changed so that If you're even at a second tier university or a first tier university, you don't write anymore for college students. You don't. So it's not only that you don't engage the surrounding community; it's that your scholarship is only directed at your peers. And if you want to get tenure, the way the knowledge production system goes now, you don't write anything challenging. You don't write anything. You try to. It's sort of a people pleasing skill in which you take the safest route, no risks. So I think we really do have to bring that in, the fact that one of the reasons that we're having a crisis in liberal education is that scholars, to a large extent, no longer write for what we used to call the educated public, because the educated public, the college graduates, is so fragmented. It doesn't seem to exist anymore. So I think it would be like one of the problems with creating a dialogue between universities and surrounding communities is not just their location, because we can do that over the internet. Mm-hmm. It's that there's no place in our society for that discourse.
People write The Simpsons for the educated public today.
Right. Yeah.
Martha Nussbaum, I have a different sort of question, but it has to do with the global piece, which everybody says is, you know, part of the great adjustment that has to be made, that's been made since I was in college. It also strikes me, though, that university campuses, rich and poor, state and private, are the most diverse global places that we know, more than our neighborhoods, more than our offices. What, if anything, do the colleges and universities have to be taught about the new global reality?
Well, yeah, I'd like to go back to the last point if I have a chance.
Do it.
Got to go soon. But anyway, yeah, I think they're not all that diverse, because you're privileged if you ended up at the University of Chicago. So what they really need to learn about is poverty. I mean, they need to learn that there are lots of nations that have 50% literacy. So then the number of people who are actually in higher education at all in a nation like India is a tiny elite. So they better learn about that. Hmm. And they better learn about it not just through reading some statistics, but hopefully by incorporating some sort of study abroad or travel into their education. But I just
30 seconds to make your other point.
The 30 seconds. I think that we all want to address the general public. I chair the Committee on Public Philosophy in the Philosophical Association, and I have passionate meetings where people are desperate to do that. It's just that the media in this country do not accept the things that scholars write. They don't want to hear from us. And that is not true in other countries. In the Netherlands, I just had a group of 500 people talking about justice for people with disabilities. You know, and I think that we better look at our own public culture and ask why we're so different.
I couldn't agree. I think the media does stand in the way of public curiosity, but the internet, praise God, does not. That's my humble opinion. Martha Nussbaum, thank you for joining us. Susan Gallagher, thank you. David Schaefer, Amardeep Singh, and Razib Khan, thank you all. You can keep talking about curriculums, curricula. You can help us work on the next shows at radioopensource.org, where you can also download any show and subscribe to Open Source as a podcast. Open Source is produced in association with the University of Massachusetts Lowell and WGBH Radio in Boston. The program is made possible by the Schooner Foundation, whose contributors support Physicians for Human Rights, promoting health by protecting human rights, www.phrusa.org. RadioOpenSource.org is hosted by Contegix, contegix.com. Our show is produced by David Miller, Brendan Greeley, Catherine Bidwell, Chelsea Murs, Robin Amer, and Greta Pemberton, with help from Jessica Miller, John LaRue, and Rob Keir. Ray Fallon was our engineer. Mary McGrath is the dean of our college. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.
PRI, Public Radio International.